Well, I'd just like to say hello to author and researcher Toyni Newton on behalf of Radio Free UK, who I believe has written one of the most important books ever on the European Union. The book is titled The Occult Origins of the European Union. I'd just like to hold up the very striking cover. The Occult Origins of the European Union, which is available on...
from lulu.com and from Watkins Books in London.
In London, not far from Trafalgar Square.
Not that far, it's near more near Leicester Square than
Leicester Square. Brilliant. So, Toyni, please could you introduce yourself and how you came to write the book?
Right, well, I'm Toyni Newton, as you've just said. I was born in South London, where I lived in a street called Lonsdale Gardens, near the London Road and Norbury Station. But my family soon moved down to the Sussex coast, where I've been ever since. However, I did return to London to work for a little while, but after one or two false starts career-wise, I eventually enrolled at Worthing Art College, where I did a photography course. But after graduating from there and going around London once more, I was seeing guys looking at people who have their own studios, etc., looking for work, be their assistants, as one does. But what I found was with these people that whilst they were very successful guys in what they were doing, they weren't happy, they didn't have the career satisfaction. So I kind of drifted away from photography and towards writing, which was probably a natural thing to do because my mother is a published author. She's done sort of gothic-y type stuff, sort of thrillers mixed with romance type of thing. And so I suppose I would say it's in my blood, writing is in my blood. And in that respect, I was drawn towards, for my first project, a local mystery that involved much unexplained phenomena, UFOs, paranormal activity, and witches, covens, and such like. Everything but the kitchen sink, you could say, at a location called Clapham Woods, near West Sussex. I looked into this and that led me to writing three articles on the subject, which were all published in the Unexplained magazine.
Unexplained magazine.
Yeah,
very
that's
good.
Right. Yeah. And this was the trigger for what was to come. Various individuals began to turn up, some of whom I began working with, and they had certain bits of information which led me to expand the whole project, and I published my first book as a result, called The Demonic Connection, which was more kind of occult based, which was published in Blandford Press, by Blandford Press in February 1987, exactly 30 years ago.
Wow.
At the end of February, would you believe? So this is its 30th anniversary.
I believe, was it Canon Dominic Walker?
That's correct, yes, the Vicar of Brighton. He wrote the preface, yeah, he was the introduction.
I believe at one time he was the Church of England's leading exorcist.
Yeah, that's correct.
So he had someone of great credibility and integrity.
Yeah, he became Bishop of Reading sort of after that.
That's right.
But this book focused on statements from various people and historical research as well, all of which culminated in a core of evidence which firmly suggested, it didn't prove, but it firmly suggested that there was a dark magical order who were active in the region and had been using not only Clapham Woods but the Chanctonbury Ring and other areas because they're all connected by ley lines and such like. This is what some of these magical orders look for. They look for they're very into the theory of ley lines as harnessing power, magical power, which is neutral. I would stress that power is neutral, it's not bad or good, it's just, well,
it's neutral, it's the operators, the people that use it, that either make it positive or negative, or use it for their own ends.
Sure. So if you could sort of briefly summarise your previous works leading up to the book on the EU, I mean, I'm aware just with what you're saying, you know, I remember an author, Andrew
Collins.
I'm
just about to bring him into the introduction.
In some of his works were suggesting that there were some dark esoteric groups that were sort of seeking to undermine the national kind of spiritual grid system in his analysis. And
what I was doing was, if you like, it was more on a partly historical basis, partly on a hypothetical basis. But it involved more orthodox methods of research. What Andrew had done was that he'd used psychics, and his stuff was very cutting edge at that time, which made it very interesting. We combined together. I sort of worked with him and collaborated with him on certain things. And he gave me quite a bit of information, some of which I used in my next project, which was the Dark Worship, which included a bit of the Clapham stuff, a little bit of updates, but expanded nationally and internationally. We go on to what was going on, but based very much on history, which went right back to the sort of ancient times, the kings and queens, the Tudors, who were very involved in magical stuff, Catherine de' Medici, who was, if anything, satanic, you know, was the stuff that turned up. She was doing in France, one of the Medici family, who married into French nobility. So it covered a lot of a much wider scope, a much bigger picture of various aspects of the occult and the power. That connects with it both in spiritual terms and in practical terms, in regard to the people, some of the people that are using it.
Did any of this research that you did any of it lead back in some respect whatsoever to the EU?
I didn't know or realise. The EU wasn't in my thoughts at that time. We're going back now to the early 2000s. But there was anything remotely like that would be connected to it. One thing I do remember, and I was fairly neutral on the EU at that time, I was neither for or against it, but I think in 2002, about the time of Dark Worship was published, there was a major incident whereby the whole of the EU Commission resigned, or had to resign, led by Jacques Santer, the Frenchman, over corruption charges, allegations. And they all had to go, and they all went, all fell on their swords together, and were replaced, and that's when Barroso, I think, came in. So that was a kind of hint that, you know, all was not well in the EU, and perhaps there was something going on here. That sort of early 2000 period, I started to develop some serious health issues, which had to be sorted out, and it took me a while to get over them. And then after that, I was approached by Jonathan Tapsell, another writer and also filmmaker, and that who was based over here in Brighton at one time, doing stuff. And he'd moved to London, and he'd come down to see me and said, "Look, I've got this book project. I want us both to work on it, because it's a big project about the occult history of London." And as soon as I heard about it, as soon as he sort of pitched it my way, I thought, wow, I've got to do this. You know, you have some of these eureka moments, they come along from time to time, and this was one of them. And I just thought, I've got to work with John on this one. And so after having our first meeting, we were looking for a title, and I came up with London's Mystical Legacy. And that's what we worked on. That was the title of the book. There is no city in the world, really, that is quite like London in regard to its so-called, if you want to put it like that, magical, mystical secret history. I mean, from the alleged founder, Brutus of Troy, who was said to have raised several temples, one of the pagan temples on the site, one of which is now at St. Paul's Cathedral, where St. Paul's Cathedral is, to the dragons which guard, one of which guards the city of London, entrance to the city of London, that the temple area, where the Knights Templar, inside the temple area where the Knights Templar shrine is. The whole of London is seemingly underpinned by a mystical heritage that boasts a much wider scope than you might actually think. Mm. For example, directly on the land that's occupied, currently occupied by the Houses of Parliament, there was once a Druidic circle. It was on a site called Thorny Island, and this is where the Druids first enacted their laws and conducted certain rituals in order to protect their circle. So various things like that, which I wasn't expecting. This all went into the sort of melting pot to create London's mystical legacy. We also looked at the role of the crown in all of this. Now, with the crown, I'm not talking about the Queen or even the crown jewels. I'm talking about the Crown Committee that administers the City of London and enacts the laws, because it is responsible for administering the City of London, which is a separate, independent principality to the actual London area itself. It has its own police force, it has its own government, the Crown Committee.
A state within a state, similar to the Vatican or...
Like that, yes, indeed.
In America, the Pentagon.
Yeah, very similar sort of situation.
Yes.
And they have similar... They don't necessarily have the same views as the rest of London, and that's where all the, naturally, the finance and the sort of social...
Is it true that even the Queen has to sort of ask permission to enter?
She has to ask permission to enter.
A square mile of the city.
A square mile, and then the Mayor of London agrees to her entering, but he acknowledges the fact that she is the sovereign. And so he gives her his sword, which he carries his sword around, okay. The mayor's ceremonial sword, which I think has to be passed back to him when she leaves. So they do a bit of an exchange on that level. There's all sorts of stuff like that, very, very strange things, very strange rituals, which I mean...
Allegedly sort of Masonic. Type.
Some of them are, yes. Yeah. And of course, they are more...
Order the Garter.
Yeah, and there are more lodges in the City of London, I think, than anywhere. And a lot of them connect... a lot of the banks have their own lodges, their own Masonic lodges. And of course, you've got the whole law system there as well. The whole legal framework, which is in the temple. So it's a whole... things, a whole concentration of power that's there.
Right, these three books that we've briefly discussed, The Demonic Connection, The Dark Worship, London's Mystical Legacy, I just want to bring us now into the book, The Occult Origins of the European Union, and how the research you did on those books led, in a way, into the research that you've done in the book on the EU and
right.
You know, how you become aware of something quite sinister at work within the formation of the European Union. Because you said at one time you were quite neutral about the EU, but what if, and you referred to a eureka moment. What was
the eureka moment
opened you to the dangers inherent in the EU?
Right, the eureka moment for me, as I explain actually in the book, is when I was watching, there was a lot of, in the late sort of about 2000, well, yeah, in the late 2000 periods, about 2007-08, of independent TV stations that were coming out through Paradigm Shift TV and something called Edge Media, which were very cutting edge, which were doing interviews and doing sort of short films and presentations before audiences that you just wouldn't see anywhere else.
Sort of like people like Brian Gerrish.
Brian Gerrish, certainly.
Common Purpose.
Precisely,
Ian Crane and others of that sort of.
And I used to watch these regularly, and some of these were good, some maybe were a bit iffy, but there was mainly some very good stuff there. But the eureka moment that you mentioned came when I was happened to be watching a Paradigm Shift TV presentation by somebody who was in one of Karen Sawyer's, she runs the alternative research community, and they do these sort of talks every year. And one of these films, presentations had been filmed. And there was a guy there from an internet group called, I think, Red Ice Productions, called Ulrik Pellgren, a Swedish guy. And he was delivering a talk called The Hidden Roots of the European Union. And I watched this talk, because as I say, it was put on television. The talk had already been done, it had been filmed, and it was about some 6 months or a year previously. And that completely acted as the trigger for me to do the EU book. Because he was talking about the symbolism of Europa, the goddess, and all sort of occult stuff. But was connected to the EU. So I thought, well, I'm going to look into this and see where it takes me. And it probably took me much further than I actually thought into the sort of darker elements that are behind the EU, which very few people know about it. There's a few authors like Christopher Story, Rodney Atkinson, people like that who have gone into it and have, I've since discovered, have also come to the same conclusions.
People that perhaps more concentrated on the concept of, you know, has constitutional treason been enacted upon the British people, whereas you in the book go into that in some detail, but you. What's unique about your book is that you really go into the esoteric symbolism behind the formation of the EU.
Yeah, certainly.
You just mentioned about the goddess Europa. I mean, there's big chunks of the book that talk about goddess Europa, the woman riding the beast, which I believe alludes to biblical symbolism about the Whore of Babylon, the Tower of Babel, and the building in Strasbourg, and the EU flag with its 12 stars.
Well, if we take the first of those the picture of the image of Europa riding the beast, the woman riding the beast, I mean, that comes out, it's on a lot of stamps, it's on a lot of coins, posters. Well, you'll see it all around the EU.
Statues
outside. I mean, it's outside the main buildings. I mean, there are variations of the figure, but it's always the woman riding the beast. The woman is in control of the beast as well. That's the other thing. And this image it equates with also with various other goddesses as well, with because it also relates to the goddess, the woman holding the child. With the 12 stars. The 12 stars of the EU, most people think on that EU flag that those 12 stars represent the countries of the EU that were in the EU at the time that it was created, but it doesn't, they don't. They actually represent the goddess. They are the mother, the so-called mother goddess, which again is identified with Europa because it's although it's the Virgin Mary in the modern sense, the origins of it go back to Babylon and Inanna, Ishtar, Babylonian stuff, Babylonian praxis, which again relates to Europa. Europa and Semiramis, the sort of icon of Babylon, consort of Nimrod, are both sort of identified with each other. They have these very similar characteristics. And as I'll come on to in a moment, the Tower of Babel, which Nimrod built, figures very prominently in the EU symbolism.
I believe that the building at Strasbourg is actually modelled after a famous painting of the Tower of Babel.
That's right. It's by a Dutch, a Belgian actually.
And it's featured on the Brugel. EU posters as well.
Well, somebody called Brugel, if that's the correct name. And of course it's depicted, it's an unfinished work. And the EU poster showing the Tower of Babel is the same thing. Mm. And the EU building of the Tower of Babel is again the same. It's been deliberately looked like an unfinished building because it's several bits of it look as if they're missing at the top of the building. And when it was finished, one journalist actually posed a question, why the Tower of Babel? And one of the EU officials commented, Nimrod failed to do sort of 3,000 years ago, or 3,000 BC, or whenever it was, we intend to do now. Now, what does that exactly mean? Doesn't that mean that they're going to introduce something along the lines of Nimrod was actually doing? I mean, it was a pretty pagan.
Well, in the biblical tradition, Nimrod is seen as a prototype of the Antichrist.
Absolutely.
And the whore of Babylon, the woman riding the beast, is also a feminine personification of something that is in satanic rebellion against God.
Yes, that's certainly the Christian interpretation of that. But if I could refer to somebody called Leon Marshall, if I can find a quote in the book, so just bear with me while I go through this. But this is an important quote. Right. Right, here we are. Leon Marshall, what he said, he's, first of all, he was a General Secretary to the Council of Europe between 1953 and 1955. And what he said was, he confirmed that the stars on the flag, these are the 12 stars of the flag of Europe, are those of the woman of the apocalypse. And he said, it's wonderful that we have gotten back to the introit of the new mass of the Assumption. It is the Corona Stellarum, gave some Latin name, the crown of 12 stars, the woman of the apocalypse. Mm-hmm. Now, this is an official of the European Union, the General Secretary to the Council of Europe, who is coming out with this stuff that actually says, well, it's the woman of the apocalypse, it's what we're into here, you know. And that again got me thinking, well, what are they into? You know, if they're into this. What could be interpreted by Christians certainly as satanic at the very least, even if you try and maintain a neutral stance on it, it's pretty dark stuff. If this is kind of driving, a kind of spiritual driving force behind some of them.
Also in the book you develop, leading on from all this symbolism, Goddess Europa, Woman Riding the Beast, Tower of Babel, the EU flag with 12 stars, but also there's a significant chapter on the Pergamon altar, which is also referred to in the Book of Revelation.
Yes, this is
which has some connection as well to the EU.
Yes, this is basically Pergamon was an ancient city fairly near Troy, in what is now Turkey, but it was in Greece at that time. When Troy fell, sort of roughly, I don't know, 1300 BC, 1500, probably about 1300 BC, people emigrated from there and they went into Pergamon. And this altar was created, and it was a pagan altar, a massive, great thing, extraordinary feat of building and engineering, which showed the sort of battle of the gods on there. And it became known as the Zeus altar.
Wow.
And of course, Zeus is, in bull god form, is the generally considered to be the person behind the Europa myth, who carried Europa off into the sea and to an island where they fostered children. That's in the Greek myth, but there's also an ancient, a more ancient Phoenician one, which has Europa actually as a real person rather than a mythical character, which is quite interesting, in that she was actually the daughter of Canaan, which brings us into sort of Noah territory rather, and the whole sort of fallen angel thing. So it all depends which one of these two kind of avenues you want to go down. Was she just merely a mythical person that you had cottoned onto, or is there a little bit more behind that, a little bit something more credible behind that?
Something going back to Genesis.
Yeah, in terms of an actual bloodline, or an actual birth line. I couldn't actually say which one was accurate. I followed both of them in the book, you know, so I'm just presenting both of them as alternative things. But in both of these accounts, she was actually raped by Zeus in the form of the bull god. So it was very interesting that Zeus was the sort of allegedly dedicated, this altar was actually dedicated to him, the Pergamon altar. Well, it got buried in the coming of Christianity, you know, to carry the story forward. But it was rediscovered, and it lay dormant and covered by rubble, all sort of ravages of the ages for 2,000 years, because I think it was constructed about 3rd century BC, something like that, 2nd century BC. It was rediscovered in the 19th century by a German architect called Karl Humann, who found it, started digging, realised what it was, and bought the whole thing, got the funding, and brought the whole thing back to Germany.
Germany.
Mm. And it was reconstructed in Berlin.
Wow.
And it reopened, the actual building of it, and it reopened in 1930, it was either in the late 20s or early 30s at the time, of course, but it was coming to power.
Wow, right.
During the war, it was it was taken away. The Russians, I think, got there first, and they took bits of it. They took it away, what was left of it. But then, some 10 years later, Nikita Khrushchev, the president of Russia, decided that he didn't want anything to do with it, and it wasn't a very nice thing to have around. So he gave it back to Germany, and they reconstructed it again for a second time, is currently housed in one of the main museum centres in Berlin. So it's back in Berlin, right at the centre of Europe.
And referred to in St. John's Book of Revelation.
Yes, it is.
Satan has his throne.
Yeah, this is where a Christian bishop, Bishop Antipas, or I can't quite remember exactly without referring to the book again, his name, where he was murdered by a practitioner, a pagan practitioner, which actually led to becoming of Christianity. That was a sort of spur in Pergamon, and the sort of abandoning of the altar, so it fell into disrepute after this.
I can see where the sort of contemporary missionaries like, you know, David Hathaway, who made a very interesting documentary called The Rape of Europe, where he was, you know, developing his concept of Seuss being a rapist. And the sort of
that is very much in tune with both the myths and both the stories that surround Europa, in terms of whether she was a Phoenician goddess, daughter of Canaan, whether she was a real person, or whether she was just a mythical character, the daughter of King Agenor, who gave his name to the Aegean Sea.
Okay,
so it's quite. It all depends which one. I mean, you go back in time, and I mean, you can't prove which is myth and which is reality.
But it's interesting that you in the book you go into some detail about Bergen-Alten and how it sort of was utilised by the Nazis.
Could
you say something about the fascist connection to the European Union?
Yeah, well, that's more pronounced than most people would think. Albert Speer used the design of the Bergen-Alten in one of his backdrops to the Nuremberg rallies. He used it as a programming thing to get the audience all sort of in a state of euphoria, which of course they were. Yeah. You had 200,000 of those extraordinary rallies in Nuremberg.
Yeah.
Part of that was Speer's interpretation, because he used extraordinary light shows. Mm-hmm. It's a forerunner to some of today's light shows that you see at various concerts. But some of this stuff was created by Albert Speer. Mm-hmm. So that was involved in that particular aspect of those light shows, and we based it on aspects of the Bergen-Alten. Now, just to go into the Nazi connection. There were certain individuals within the Nazi Party who had ideas for the European Union, what is now the European Union. And just to take a few of them, there was a chap called Walter Funk, or Walter Funk, to put it in England, English, who wrote in 1940 about the necessity to have a central European Union and a European economic area for fixed exchange rates. And he was an economic minister in the Nazi setup. He was one of Hitler's people. Going on a little bit further, one of the key characters of the Nazi link was a chap called Walter Hallstein. If I can find him, I've got about four pages on him. He was a former Nazi lawyer, and he gave he gave a speech at Nuremberg. He was one of the people who spoke at Nuremberg in 1939. Where he said that he was talking about the legal entity of Greater Germany, and his speech was sort of about the embellishments of conquering the other states, which of course Germany were going to be in the throes of doing, or they'd already done, and they'd gone into Austria and just about to go into Poland. And he said, moreover, this process subjugates the people and the territories to the sovereignty of the mother state with its defined legislative and executive constitutional powers. And the word here, territories here, I put, refers to an occupied state, so on. Now, interesting thing about Walter Hallstein was he was a lawyer in this setup, and he was responsible for, as I say, the geopolitics of forthcoming sort of Nazi Euro state. After the war, he managed to get hold of documents and redact a lot of stuff that was very incriminating against him, and he didn't get prosecuted at Nuremberg. On the contrary, he managed to get himself involved in the European Union. And after a number of years inside the EU, he was eventually elected president of the European Commission in 1958, where he served for 10 years developing the Commission into what it is today, which is the most powerful entity. It's the legislator, isn't it? It makes the legislation in the European Union, of today's European Union, mainly at the behest of what comes out of the Bilderberg Group and, of course, the lobbyists, who they're the main people, they're the main instigators, of course.
Would there be any evidence to suggest then that that the Nazis may have seen something resembling the EU as a sort of plan B should they lose the war?
I'm going to come on to that actually in a moment, but let me just say one more thing about Hallstein, which is very important. He died in 1982, but in the Lisbon Enabling Act of 2009, that contains wording which is identical when it describes the people and the territories of the European countries as being subjugated to the sovereignty of the mother state. Brussels and the EU, together with its legislative and executive commission of powers. So they're using exactly the same phraseology in the Lisbon Treaty, the Enabling Act of 2009, as Holstein did 70 years previously in his speech to Nuremberg in 1939. And that is, on its own, is a pretty damning thing.
It's a smoking gun, isn't it?
Absolutely. Now, you were saying, you'll have to remind me again, the train of thought about...
Just the sense that is the EU, or did the Nazis see an EU superstate project as plan B should they lose the war?
Yes,
so they couldn't dominate Europe militarily, perhaps they could do it economically.
Right. In this respect, there was an author called Adam Libor, this is after the war, who was gathering data for a fictional book, or he thought it was going to be a fictional book, on leading Nazis conspiring at the end of World War II to form a Fourth Reich under the cover of the European Union. But what he did not expect to find is that there were documents, approved documents, rather than being fanciful fictional, were actually all fact. He actually dug up. And there's a US military intelligence report called the Red House Report that discloses on the 10th of August 1944, realizing that the German machine was doomed, a group of leading Nazis convened a clandestine conference at the Maison Rouge Hotel in Strasbourg, where they schemed to devise a European common market circumscribed by a corporate European Economic Federation, a Fourth Reich of their own intention. Now, there's an author called, I remember his full name, it's Paul Damien, or Damien, somebody like that, who's written a book, a very good book, which I'm hoping to get hold of soon, about Martin Bormann. Because Martin Bormann was at this conference, along with other Nazi leaders, as well as leading industrialists. From the company Bayer, who are, of course, Bayer were part of the IG Farben cartel, the big pharmaceutical cartel, which contained BASF and Brecht and Bayer. They were the three components of that company. Well, it was broken up after the war, but Bayer, of course, remained. They are also the biggest funders of the EU, one of the most regular funders of the EU. They've been behind the European Union, the European Economic Community, right from the start. And of course, they have just bought Monsanto.
Oh, wow.
So there's a lot going on there. And as far as we know, or as far as I'm aware, they are continuing the policies of Monsanto. So again, as I said, a lot of stuff going on there in that respect.
I mean, also, one name that has seemed to have come up quite a lot recently, but which few people had even heard about, but I think your book must be one of the first books ever to mention this particular individual, and this was an individual that was quite active in the original Pan-Europa movement of the 1920s, so this is before the Second World War. Could you perhaps explain the significance of Count Richard Guggenhave Kolarghi
and
his book Practical Idealism? I may have pronounced his name
right.
wrong. Maybe you could give us a full name
I'll try.
And the proper pronunciation. It's quite a mouthful.
Right, here goes. Count Richard Niklas Guggenhave Kolarghi. If I'm right, I may be wrong, but I think that's probably it.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Now,
to me.
He wrote a book, as you rightly said, called Practical Idealism, which described the racist and supremacist roots and the ideology behind the European Union, according to one website. And he is seen as the spiritual godfather of the European Union. When he'd written this book, I mean, his ultimate vision was, somewhat similar to Hitler, although both of them were completely at odds, they hated and despised each other. Kolarghi's ultimate vision was of one world government ruled by a spiritual elite combining Freemasons along with their royal representatives, including nobility and gentry of Europe, which seized the means of power of society and used them for the blessing of the general public, whatever that means. That sounds a bit patronising to me. And the Pan-Europa movement basically modelled themselves on this idea. And they used promotion of the European Union through propaganda and all sorts of other methods. But Baron Louis de Rothschild was so impressed with Count Caligi and his plans that he telephoned Count and requested a meeting. And in his autobiography, Goudenhove Caligi writes, at the beginning of 1924, we received a call from Baron Louis de Rothschild. One of his friends, Max Warburg, from Hamburg, had read my book and wanted to get to know us. And to my great surprise, Warburg spontaneously offered us 60,000 gold marks to tide the movement over for its first 3 years. And they were a couple of other people. They were both Warburg brothers, were also at this meeting. They were both Max Warburg and his brother, Paul Warburg, who was a bigwig in the USA, and another character called Bernard Baruch, who was behind several US presidents, including Roosevelt and Truman as well. He was a major player behind the scenes in the USA. Paul Warburg had an offspring called James Warburg, is it James Paul Warburg? And he appeared before the Senate Committee in America in 1950, and he made the very chilling statement that we shall have world government, whether by consent or conquest, in the very near future. And he said this before the Senate committees, and this is all on record, not conspiracy theory, it's on record, but he said that, and he's one of the Warburgs that was impressed by Goudenhove Caligi. The biggest award in the European Union that anyone can receive is called the Goudenhove Caligi Award, and it was recently, or a couple of years ago, it's not awarded all the time, it's like a sort of fellowship award type of thing. It was awarded to Herbert von Rompuy, who of course was the president of the European Council of Ministers. So it's all wheels within wheels.
So he is, this Caligi is venerated within the EU.
Absolutely, he's an object of veneration, he's the spiritual godfather, I think I said at the beginning.
Even though his book at one point has been
banned in Germany. Yeah.
Practical Idealism. And exactly. I also understand he chose the anthem of the EU.
Now, I've got something else, if I can find it, about the
Ode
anthem.
To Joy.
Ode to Joy.
And obviously he had some significant influence on the EU flag.
Yes, that's
which
right.
Which has been somewhat adaptive from the original emblem of the Pan-Europa movement.
Yes, that's right. I'm going to have to just go through and find my place in here. Because give me a few minutes.
Well, I also understand that in Practical Idealism, he speaks about wanting to, in a way, get rid of white and black people and have a race of...
Shall we just go on to this? I'll come back to that in a moment. I found this on EU. It's called Ode to Joy, the EU national anthem. And it's the prelude to the last moment of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. And it's supposed to read as an ode to freedom by a way of a sense of collectivism within the EU member states. But the lyrics for this musical piece were actually written by someone called Friedrich von Schiller. And they read rather differently. And the words concern entering a temple dedicated to the worship of the goddess of the old religion by uniting all those who enter the temple in brotherhood through power of magic and ritual. So it's dedicated to a goddess, and no guesses as to which one it's dedicated to. Europa, obviously, in her spiritual form. So that's another occult pagan link. Now, going, sorry, just refresh my memory on the other point you wanted
to mention. Well, there appears to be, even as early as the 20s in his book Practical Idealism, a concept of almost weaponized mass migrationism.
Yes. This is indeed very. What his plan was to have a sort of the mixed race plan was to have as kind of serfs, if you want to put it, the underlings, as a sort of race of Middle Eastern people like ancient Egyptians mixed with Europeans. This was long, as you say, it was as long ago as 1920s. In other words, a sort of mass migration.
Yeah.
Idea. And of course, guess what's happening now, or what's been happening for the last few years, and still happening in Germany and places like that. There are various places all over Europe.
So, would you say there is a case to be made, therefore, that mass migration has been weaponized by the EU to destroy national sovereignty and identity? You know, this kind of leftist narrative about no borders, and people like, I believe, Peter Sutherland,
right. Now, he's the envoy to the UN, he's the advisor to the UN on migration. And he was speaking to, I think it was the House of Lords in 2012. He made a speech saying that the EU should be doing its best to break down the homogeneity, or sovereignty or individual member states. And then in the next sentence he said the EU should also be, at the same time, encouraging mass migration and promoting mass migration in order to achieve this process. Some words to that effect. So I mean, if we link the two together, what he's actually saying is that he wants mass migration to be the method of breaking down the homogeneity of the individual states, so we have this whole collective thing of this sort of Middle Eastern come European populace, which is exactly what Gutenberg-Kalergi wanted in the 1920s.
So
he's realising the Gutenberg-Kalergi dream.
Absolutely, and some people have seen that within the EU there is a more expansionist project that will, you know, taking Turkey as the gate to the Middle East and,
quite possibly,
and North Africa. And I notice in your book there's a brief allusion to the Jewish historian Bat Yeor and her concept of Eurabia.
Yeah, now this was something that started in 1973, and this again coincided with our entry into the European Union. And it was when the European Union really started to grow. It had been growing steadily because the whole concept of the EU used to do it drop by drop, one step at a time. But that was the kind of launching pad of the EU getting more and more member states. And what this Eurabia project basically was about was that it was going to be centred in France, but where some EU member states would receive immigrants from Saudi Arabia and various other Arab countries in return for the Saudis keeping the oil price low. Because, of course, at that time, I think this was 73, 74, we'd have the two oil price rises in 74, which had shocked the oil, caused the panic with all these petrol costs almost doubling in that time. So they had to find a way to negate that. And so this sort of Eurabia plan, which was secretly going on at the time, was sort of brought forward to be the answer to that in some respects.
I know some Christians have said that there's no reference to Christianity in the Lisbon Treaty as the sort of, if you like, the historical faith of Europe, and much to the dismay of the Vatican at the time, and that maybe was enabling the EU to be able to assimilate migrants from presumably more Islamic orientated countries.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, again, this is what we're all within the advocacy of Peter Sutherland, which he was trying to do through the UN as well. And again, we go back to the Kudenhove-Kalegi dream.
So
being enacted.
His plan is being enacted.
It does seem so. Yeah. It does seem that there's a bit of that present.
Yeah. With that in mind, then, where does the US fit into this? Because, you know, you mentioned people like Rothschild and Warburg and maybe people within America that were seeking to influence the early development of the Pan-Europa movement. And we think about the Marshall Plan after the Second World War. And some people of a more leftist sort of narrative sometimes seek to personify the EU as this kind of bulwark against America. Whereas in your book you suggest that, you know, the America, corporatist America, big business corporatist America, has always been behind the formation of an EU superstate. I mean, could you just say a few comments about that?
There's a very interesting plan in David Barmby's book, which is called The EU, A Corporatist Racket. And it's only recently come out in the last couple of years or so. What David Barmby has done is that he's gone to the Public Records Office at Kew Gardens in London, near Richmond, and he spent a lot of time there getting these files, special release files, which have been under the 30-year clause of secrecy. These are all formally classified documents. And photocopying them and bringing them home and going through them, the painstaking work, and he's uncovered a lot of stuff about the EU and the conspiracy involving within it to keep its true intentions secret, if you like, and just reveal them one step at a time. And one of the things that he got hold of was the fact that the CIA, in the London office of the CIA, they were working with ACU, which is the American Committee for United Europe, and they were working together to raise funds which would be directly channeled through into the European movement. Now, the European movement, and we're going back to 1973 now, 74, before the 75 referendum for us to stay in or leave the European Union, pretty much the same as the one we've just had. And what they were doing was, once the money got into the European movement was right at the centre of the whole campaign, which the Commission, European Commission, were running, and that money then won't be sent out to the various propaganda channels and so on to sort of ramp up the pro-EU, staying in the EU.
Were they wanting a single European market
for their export base,
America exports to a single market rather than sovereign countries?
All the previous US presidents have wanted this. The only difference, of course, that's happened in the past few months is the current one, Trump, apparently doesn't. He wants to deal with people individually, counted individually, which may well benefit us, but we don't know. It's early days in all this stuff.
Suffice to say that the EU has always been a neoliberal corporatist project.
Oh, yes.
Centralising political and economic power in an unelected, undemocratic elite.
Absolutely. I couldn't have put it better myself, Wayne. That's absolutely correct. Yeah.
With that in mind, then, there seems to be a lot of speculation at the moment about the formation of an EU army. You know, we have the European Union, it's got its own constitution, its own parliament, its own flag, national anthem. And yet people still attack Brexiteers as being nationalistic, whereas you could make the case, well, the EU project is a nationalist project. It wants a country called Europe, an army, a flag, a constitution, a parliament, a currency, a judiciary. It's a Europol police force that I believe isn't subject to prosecution. So, I mean, with that in mind, could you just say something about the EU army and, the dangers inherent in that? You know, is there a possible situation where we could come out of the single market but then be caught up in an EU army? Because I believe there was suggestions that the EU could even have control of Britain's nuclear deterrent.
Right, well, there is a document here, and you'll have to bear with me again because I need to find.
I believe this is something that the UK column have been keen to develop. And your voice too.
Sorry, I'm not actually.
Okay.
Right, this is. Here we go, this is the document. Right, let's get the description of this. Right, this is a document which was prepared by someone called David Ellis, and he's with a group called Strategic Defence Initiates. He's a defence analyst, and he knows a lot of people within the defence industry, a lot of people in Parliament he's worked with, and in the Lords as well, military people. So a very bona fide source. And we had the title of this document is EU to take control of British nuclear deterrent, and it's been this was prepared on the 25th of January 2017, and it was aired by the UK column by Brian Gerrish and Mike Robinson, and they are the only people to have done so. And this is what David Ellis has to say about Brexit. He says the British referendum has made no difference to the speed and tenacity with which the Conservative government under Prime Minister Theresa May and Secretary of State for Defence Sir Michael Fallon, a strong EU advocate and former EU movement supporter, are continuing the path to EU military union. There has been no change in the advancing integration of UK military forces into the EU structure. The subject is simply not discussed in political, public and media forums, which is testimony to the usual EU policy of implementation by stealth where possible. And he goes on in the second paragraph to say, perhaps most dangerous here is the rapid integration of the EU commercial military procurement and supply chain, operating under an EU treasury already being declared and implemented. Once locked together under EU procurement rules, and with joint interoperability, if I can say that, doctrine driving the pan-EU military needs, Britain will be further stripped of its ability to design, build and supply our own weapons and munitions. This will further strengthen the EU political tactic of operating interdependence between EU member states as a tool for removing sovereignty, identity and the ability to act as an independent sovereign state. I mean, understanding EU military policy, it goes on, I'll just quote these two small paragraphs. The EU has consistently and publicly stated that the goal of the EU is to form a single, integrated, supranational state with law, international security, defence and foreign policy controlled from Brussels. And then it goes on in Britain's case to say, forming an EU military requires a number of significant hurdles that have to be overcome, and these include integrating the EU and French strategic nuclear deterrents to bring them under centralised EU political control. So there you have it. That is the plan. And whilst Brexit appears to be happening, and people are arguing about it, and they're going to march either against or for it in these, rather against it in these marches that are planned at the end of March. No one is looking at what's really happening in this context, in this very important stuff that David Ellis via the UK column is flagging up. Because there isn't going to be a Brexit if this goes ahead. in its current form. If this EU, and it's an EU defence as well as an EU army. It's the whole. It's not just the army. It's the whole thing. It's sort of it's the treasury as well, because it has to be funded by an EU treasury, which will be based in Brussels. Because if it's a whole EU army, it can't be funded by individual states. Well, obviously they'll be asked to contribute, but it's going to be under an EU treasury, centralised, again, centralised control.
Also, in your book, I mean, you talk about TTIP, which apparently has been defeated when Trump was elected.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first things he did was rip up the document, mm-hmm. but in your book you further develop other UN backed plans like Codex Alimentarius and Agenda 21.
Yeah, Agenda 21, that's now become Agenda 2030, but it's the same thing. It was devised by somebody called Maurice Strong, and it was opened up at one of his global conferences back in 1992 and then adopted by the UN. And what it involves basically is Strong has been on record, first of all, as saying that the only way to get his agenda going is for there to be a financial crash and the end of the sort of current governmental situation as we know it, with individual nation states being in control of their own situation, their own destiny. Something like Agenda 21 can only really work if there's world nationalisation. In other words, everything is nationalised under a world government. Nobody owns anything. And people are all sort of put into homes which are supposedly environmentally friendly, but you can hardly swing a cat in, so to speak.
Well, as George Orwell called it, oligarchical collectivism.
Yes, yeah, and so much of this is based on what Orwell said. It's frightening, but there doesn't seem to be that many people who can actually see it, apart from just a few writers here and there who are sort of flagging it up.
It's sort of interesting that, you know, George Orwell, as a socialist and an English patriot, that his two of his most well-known books, Animal Farm 1984, are very much a sustained critique of the left. And I just wonder, you know, through a lot of these demonstrations against Brexit, it's almost like there seems to be a counterinsurgency at the financial behest of Goldman Sachs and George Soros and that there's this sort of high international finance capital that are bankrolling and neutralising, ironically, the organised political left.
Yes, it's wheels within wheels and one side turning in on the other, except they're both supposed to be on the same side. This is the type of thing that you get, but a lot of the people on the anti-Brexit side, on the Remain side, still don't get it. And it's almost as if they're adhering to the EU situation of wanting to be part of the EU, almost on a religious basis. Mm. And that is what the EU itself has become. It does consider itself to be a religion, and we have now certain people who are prepared to do anything to keep us in it, almost on a religious basis. The fact they can't see what the faults are within the European Union, and they would rather be part of that than be part of something.
It's almost like a blind faith, and anyone who produces a counter narrative is a heretic. So it's almost like a witch hunt. That's where we come into political correctness and Frankfurt cultural Marxism that pretty much dominates the whole kind of debate on this at times. With you know, political correctness in mind, and I mean, what do you see as in a contemporary situation the significance of political parties like UKIP that have really stolen Labour's thunder and appear to be becoming, if you like, the alternative to Labour, allegedly, you know, but then some people would sort of colour all opposition to the EU as driven by a kind of right wing sort of view, you know. Is it like a kind of divide and rule?
Oh, very much so, very much divide and rule.
Yeah.
And a lot of these political parties are being played anyway,
yes.
I think, by the view. I mean, there is a theory going around, well, it's more than just a theory, that the elites are getting kind of smaller and smaller, but they are very, it's just a small group of people that kind of run the agenda. But those people have a lot of influence. And the whole idea is the Hegelian dialectic, as it's called, after Hegel, the 18th century, or 19th century French, well, German philosopher, an important figure, and that is the sort of divide and rule. And that's exactly what we're having. We've got it in Brexit. I mean, it's completely divided the nation. They've had it over in the US. A divided nation. We're both divided nations.
Mm. And the sort of, like, say, the Hegelian dialects of left wing and right wing, and the need to go beyond that, because that's the way it seems that they're trying to sort of play it.
Exactly.
To see anyone that's opposed to the EU is somehow a bigot or
stupid,
a racist,
or right wing again. Again, we're getting these labels of left, right, and that, which is stopping people from coming together and embracing the situation. Okay, we've got Brexit. We're going to be independent. Well, let's go forward together. Let's embrace it together and not in total conflict. I mean, if the result had been the other way around, and we'd have still been part of the EU, naturally I would have been, along with a lot of other people, would have been extremely upset and angry. But eventually, one would have had to accept totalitarianism, veiled totalitarianism, and we'd have tried our best to kind of work with it, but at the same time trying to reform it, and that would have been the only way to have gone forward with it.
A lot of people are very sceptical that it's put itself beyond reform.
You can't reform the EU, exactly. So
that's very much the Green Party line. We're going to stay in the EU and reform it.
No, well, they're not.
And yet, how many times have you ever seen Caroline Lucas confronting the EU on YouTube over its authoritarian centralisation of political economic power,
and again,
its anti-democratic constitution? Never.
And the fact that we've managed to stop coming out of the EU, the transfer of complete transfer of powers under the Lisbon Treaty, there would have been 44 areas of policy which affect every area of our society, every area of our life, including culture. I mean, what business? Our culture is our own, it doesn't belong to anybody else. What business would the EU have to take control of our culture? But it's in those measures which, if we'd have stayed in the EU, would have been transferred to Brussels.
Is it true they would have also literally seek to abolish England as regionalisation plan that was spoken about?
There are a couple of maps. One of both of them that deal with this regionalisation plan. One has, in terms of where we are now, right in the southeast, has Calais as the capital of the southeastern region. So we've got a southeastern capital of England, which is actually in France. The other one, the most recent one on the Europarl website, which appeared, I think, a couple of years ago, in 2014-15, just before the referendum, that had a similar type of regionalisation, it was just basically called southeastern region, western region, northern region, or whatever. Didn't actually have Calais as the capital of the southeastern region. That seemed to have been removed. So obviously a concession had been made there, but it still had the regionalisation of Britain, and England was not referred to by name. That is what to that's the point to make on both of those maps.
There was no England.
There was no England. England. There was Wales and Scotland. And
no
Wales,
England.
But no England. And so that's something that's obviously still in their minds and would have been. We'd have lost, actually lost England. Just regionalised off and then turned into zones eventually. I think that was going to be the eventual plan of the whole thing.
So how important is it that Theresa May now brings in Article 50 before the date of 31st of March? Because there was some people had expressed a concern that after this date we would enter into qualified majority voting,
right,
and that would make it almost impossible to come out of the
super state. Yes, that's
a
very significant, which I flagged up in the Occult Origins of the European Union in the appendix section at the back. Qualified majority voting, it's the double majority rule that comes into operation on April the 1st, 2017. What this does is that it doubles up the amount of nations that need to give their support to a particular course of action that another member state may take, such as leaving the European Union. In other words, you would need to get 4, 8, whatever, of the other states on board in order to grant permission to do anything, basically. Leaving the European Union may still require all the 27 nations to meet to report, to agree to whatever plan is come up with, whatever plan is devised. But being that it will be devised by both us and the EU, I would think that will, hopefully that will be just a formality.
But if people like, you know, Peter Mandelson have entered the debate, Tony Blair, there seems to be this sort of like counterinsurgency by the globalists, and if they could delay the triggering of Article 50 beyond this date, would that then be a very effective sabotage?
It could be.
It's
very difficult to say which way the EU law is going to work on this.
Right.
If they know that, say it was April, the first week in April, there would obviously have to be negotiations straight away. It's something that could be negotiated out of the, it could be negotiated sort of through the situation, but it would take, I think it would obviously take longer. We wouldn't necessarily be able to come out in 2 years.
It would be another year. It's very important with that in mind then that Theresa May does trigger Article 50 the day that she said she would do.
Yeah, that's important for that, because everything has gone amazingly smoothly so far. Even with the debate in Parliament, I mean, Corbyn's role in this is very interesting, in the fact that he brought in a three-line whip on his MPs to vote with the government, which tells me that basically his heart was never in.
No, always someone close to Tony Benn, who was very anti-EU consistently.
Well, this is Tony Benn and Barbara Castle.
And like Bob Crowe, the trade unions.
Bob Crowe, he wanted to start up his own party called Say No to EU.
Yeah.
And he was on Russia Today, I watched the interview, and he got the EU, taped. You know, no wool over his eyes, but it was an elitist thing. It only worked for the bankers and various other people in the City of London. And he said, it's not for the workers at all. It's just we're not interested in the workers, and we've got to get the workers and the union bosses to say no and form our own group. And within a few weeks of that, he was dead. Strange, isn't it? I mean, this is almost like another situation similar to Hugh Gates School. Former leader.
You've got a document.
Yeah, that's right.
This is
former leader of the Labour Party. This is back in 1962. I think this is this is important. This is another Labour. And this is a quote from the biography of Gates School by somebody called Philip M. Williams. Gates School went on
21st of September 1962, Gaitskell, this is the Labour leader, he's the opposition leader, McMillan was in power at that time, and McMillan was petitioning to join the EU at that time with Edward Heath as his sort of henchman, joining federal Europe. And he said that by joining a federal Europe, this is Gaitskell, it will be the end of Britain as an independent nation. We become no more than Texas or California in the United States of Europe. It means the end of 1,000 years of history. It means the end of the Commonwealth just to become a province of Europe. And within a few weeks within 3 months of saying that, he too was dead from a mysterious illness, a rare tropical disease, it says here, which he caught after a visit to the Russian embassy in the winter of 1962-3, which was a very cold winter. So how he could catch a rare tropical disease. In fact, indeed is correct that I've written in Philip Williams's biography on Gaitskell in the winter of 62-63 in England at the Russian embassy or thereabouts is very difficult to understand. But Gaitskell was one of the only people to actually attend Bilderberg meetings as an opposition leader and to criticise them openly at the Bilderberg meetings. He was very outspoken. I mean, he wouldn't be browbeaten by then.
Could you just say something briefly about the Bilderberg group?
Well, the Bilderberg group, yes, this was started up. This is a sort of convention which has no notes, there are no notes, no sort of minutes, that's the word I was looking for, no minutes taken. It's really a discussion on the situation in world affairs and what to do about it and the agenda to bring about the changes that they think are needed. And it was started again by an ex-Nazi, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, in conjunction with somebody called Joseph Rettinger, and they've held these conferences. The first one was in the Bilderberg Hotel, which I think the White was called the Bilderberg Group, and they changed them every year. And all the leading industrialists, politicians, go to this group meetings, and it's held behind closed doors in secret, and some of them don't even like being identified when they turn up. They try and hide newspapers when they get out of their chauffeur-driven cars and all this sort of thing. And they meet them, and basically it would seem to be to just decide the agenda without having any minutes taken. It's a sort of an agenda by word, world agenda. And that's according to Daniel Estelin, the Spanish journalist, who's done a couple of
the
groups.
Media aren't allowed to be present. And
no, there's no. I mean, they occasionally get leaks. There's a guy from I think the Observer or the Guardian who managed to get sort of close to them, and they were quite friendly to him. So he thought, well, basically they're not too bad. They're okay, but most people can't get anywhere near them.
But Peter Mandelson, Tony Blair.
Peter Mandelson, Tony Blair, George Osborne. Mandelson has been an EU commissioner. That is done by invitation only. See, the EU, the tiers again, and I think a lot of the people who come out against Brexit and pro-EU don't seem to know how the EU is formed and who actually runs the EU. They probably still think the Parliament runs
yes,
it. The Parliament has no say at all.
No.
It can't. All it can do, it can elect the president of the Council of European leaders. It can elect the Commission President, but he can't do anything else. He can't even suggest or propose legislation. All he can do is rebuff it. But basically, it is just a bunch of yes men who just rubber stamp the legislation when it comes. And they have a vote on it, of course, but because most of the people are up until recently in the Parliament have been yes men, the people people from the UK, people from this country who have opposed it, and other countries, whatever legislation it is. I mean, it's basically what the Commission says that gets through. The Commission is at the top of the of this three-tiered system. It is a Commission top-down.
Some people have said it resembles the Soviet Union.
Yes, yeah, so it is.
You've got unelected commissioners who bring in the legislation.
Yeah.
And the parliament's there, just like you say, just to rubber stamp it. Whereas in this country, you could go to your MP and say, and then the MP could bring that up in parliament, what you've...
In this country, the parliament is still top-down, just. It's still sort of top-down thing, it's what we're used to. It makes the laws. It calls itself sovereign, but in fact it is us who are sovereign. We grant our sovereignty to whichever monarch is in power at the time, and he or she will enact our sovereignty in regard to our interests. But the sovereignty is then vested in the crown, but as representatives of us, and that's in the coronation oath. Wording is, although I think they may have even changed the coronation oath now. I think there was a new one brought in 1688. But
right, with that in mind, then, could you just say something about the legal system in the EU, or you know, the whole thing about corpus juris, habeas corpus?
Right, habeas corpus in our country has been our common law, and the whole thing of common law goes back to Brutus, the alleged founder, and some of his descendants, the Malmutus Code. The common law is actually based on the Malmutus Code. You're innocent until proven guilty, and that comes right through from the early days, and has been embodied in our common law and our jury system. That's habeas corpus. But very briefly, your corpus juris, it's the other way around in EU law. You are guilty and you have to prove your innocence, and they can arrest you. According to Europol, some of the sources from Europol, they can arrest you on just the premise of being a criminal, being suspected of doing something. You can be arrested, and then you have to prove your innocence. And there is no appeal process apart from going to the European Court of Human Rights, which is a separate thing anyway. And I think there is no proper appeal process as there is in this country. So it's very much loaded in favour of the state. And there's also, with its police, Europol, there's also been a shoot-to-kill policy as well. As we saw, that was enacted in 2005 with the shooting over here of John Charles de Menezes, because the shoot-to-kill policy had been brought in 2002, I think, at one of the, I think it was at the Nice Treaty or the Amsterdam Treaty, I can't remember which one, but it was in 2002. We of course, we weren't told, because the EU does things by stealth, bit by bit, but that was brought in then. And so you know, just take a look at the number of people since the early 2000s that have been killed by, shot dead by policemen. It's gone up since those times of the shoot to kill.
So under the EU, you could have a situation where the presumption of innocence is gone, there's no right to trial by jury.
They have to be very careful, because there's no trial by jury. I should have mentioned that it's done by professional magistrates. And what would have happened if we'd have stayed in the EU? We would have eventually got an ECP, European Court Prosecutor, over here, who, once that happened, then you've got trial by jury is gone, it's lost, and you're down purely to a magistrate, almost in a secret court, because that's the way the secret courts over here operate. The secret courts would take children away from their parents, and sort of things that Brian Gerrish has been looking into with the UK column, and that's what we would have. We would have over here, if we'd have stayed in the EU, that process of people being tried by a single magistrate with no real proper defence and nobody else to actually appeal to, like the members of a jury, that would eventually go, and we would be under that system of corpus juris. And perhaps the people who are going to protest at the end of March, and various other people who are still moaning about wanting to go back into the EU, should consider that before they do so. We would lose our treasured common law. Okay, no system is perfect, but it's a whole lot better to have a common law system than the corpus juris EU system.
and presumably free speech would be greatly curbed.
You know, I believe it would be. That's a moot point. It would be very difficult to see that would come about slowly. I do think, yes, you're probably right on that point, that they would find methods. I think the EU would find methods of shutting us all up eventually. And that may take a bit of time, though. But I guess it could come through their court system.
So I understand that you are currently in the early stages of writing a follow-up to the Occult Origins of the European Union.
Yes.
Would you just like to say a little bit about that sort of project? I know it's very much still in formation.
Yes, it's called The Secret Covenant, and it's an idea I got from a chap we both know called Ian R. Crane. Now, if you don't know Ian's broadcasts, I think they're things that people need to know about if they don't know them already. He does two broadcasts that go out on the internet, which go through the UK column system. One is called Humanity versus Insanity, which speaks for itself and interviews people and raises a lot of issues that the mainstream media's people are not raising. The other one is called Fracking Nightmare, which is solely about fracking and the sinking of oil wells in places where nobody wants them, not to mention the fracking and the environmental dangers that come from them thereof. He raised some time ago a document called, which I'd never heard of, called The Secret Covenant, which was uploaded onto a website, into one of the American companies, a company called BankIndex.com. I think it's a Florida-based financial company. And it contained all these sections which were very much related to the sort of the world government thing, fallen angels, and how the thing was going to be enhanced and further come about, and so on. When I first heard about it, I thought, well, that sounds very interesting. It was some years ago. And then forgot about it as I was producing this EU book. A few weeks ago, Ian flagged it up again on his site, and I thought, I've got to look up this. There could be something here. And so I got a printout of it, and lo and behold, there's a lot of stuff in there. It was actually downloaded, it appeared on the Bank Index website in 2002. So we're looking at 15 years ago now. We're in 2017, and there's a lot of stuff on there, as I said, which relates to what's happening at the moment. I was quite surprised in terms of the EU, wars, Syria, whatever. It's both prescient and pertinent. So I'm going to have a go, and I'm going to look at that, and that's what I'm going to be looking into and writing about.
So if we can bring the interview to a sort of close, if there is a sort of end game to the European Union, would you see then a United States of Europe as basically a stepping stone to a one world government?
Well, the world government must have a template, right? Anything like that, something as big as a world government must have a template. And of course their template was the European Union. If by any chance that were to cease to be, it would certainly prove to be a big dent in their process of creating a world government. It may not be the end of the matter by any means, but it would be a serious blow. It would certainly delay the process and give the people time to organise and get individually back, individualism back into their sort of lives wherever they are. We have the obviously the results of the French election to come, and Holland, Germany, Belgium, and Italy. So all sorts of things can happen there that could hasten the demise of the EU. But it's certainly on very shaky ground. It has been for some time. The austerity situation is everywhere in Europe. And Deutsche Bank, which is one of the big European banks, is on very shaky ground at the moment. That could go at any time. There are a lot of people, including Sedi and Ian Crane, who are expecting a financial crash, some sort of apocalyptic event, which won't be necessarily be the sort of death or murder of people. It'll be a financial collapse, which is going to cause mayhem for a short period throughout the globe, I would think. But that is still something that could happen if the interest rates go up any further. because the debt that has to be, that is being repaid, and it doesn't have to be repaid, it could be written off by the banks, but that's another thing altogether. What that means is that the debt would actually go up, which would make it more and more difficult for various governments, for certainly for this government to repay, because its borrowing is getting out of all proportion there. So I don't know how they're going to do it unless there is a completely new financial system whereby the money is issued by the government through Treasury rather than by an exchange of bond system and through a central bank which charges interest on it. That's partly been the problem also with various government funding projects, as well as the collapse of the financial collapse in 2008. I was going to say caused by various lending, which crazy lending basically in the States and over in this country. So there's a number of factors that would cause it, but the raising of the interest rates is certainly something. And it could be triggered by something like the fall of Deutsche Bank, while it's still in very, very dodgy areas, very bad. So I don't necessarily see, that could be the precursor to the new world government. It would need something along those lines to make people say, oh, we have to go back to what it was before, we should be back in the European Union, this wouldn't have happened if we'd have been in the European Union. I can see something like that coming about through something. It would have to be something really big, and it wouldn't just be a terrorist attack, obviously, unless it was in every country in the world at the same time. It would probably have to be something along the lines of this financial crash. If it's going to come, and hopefully it won't come, we'll get past it. But keep it in mind. Keep watching Deutsche Bank.
With that in mind, is there anything, just to sort of bring the interview to a close, is there anything else you would like to say? I'd just like to promote your book again.
Sure.
This is called The Occult Origins of the European Union by Toyne Newton, and you can purchase it at www.lulu.com.
That's right.
Or from Watkins.
Watkins Books in Central London. Presumably they're still carrying supply, but I'll make sure that's there, so they've got it. But and you can get it from Amazon, obviously. It's on Amazon and various other places. Barnes & Noble in the States, I think they've got it as well. And Waterstones, you can get it from Waterstones too. But it takes 2 weeks to come, because they won't have a regular stock. The internet companies like Amazon, Lulu you'll get it back by return from Lulu, and very quickly from Amazon as well. They're quite well stocked.
Okay, anything you'd just like to conclude on?
There's so much that obviously I could say. But basically, for people to keep their eyes open and to keep track, all is not what it seems. We've got to keep watch about this EU army. We've got to watch what the government does. When they say something, you need to be looking behind the news all the time, not at the news. And do search the internet, check out some of these alternative sites if you haven't done already. UK Column News, that's a pretty good place to start.
Andy Thomas,
there are lots of people who have independent websites who have got very interesting things to say and are doing talks. Ian R. Crane, there's Democracy Now in the States, although it's slightly left of centre, it's still a very good balanced source. In fact, Democracy Now were the only people that actually interviewed at the time of Brexit two people on the left, one of which was Left Exit, a guy from Socialist Workers who was very much in tune with what we've been saying about Brexit now, and that it's all about democracy. So that, I thought that was a very good. No one else.
And also it's worth mentioning about Green Leaves, isn't it?
Green Leaves, yes. Thank you for reminding me. I should mention.
Which I think was very significant.
Joni Jones. Not everybody in the Green Party thinks, as Caroline Lucas does, that we should be back in the EU. And Joni Jones is one of these people that doesn't. Her paper on the Green Leaves is very revealing. She's one of the few people that are saying that the EU is expanding, and that it's not, the EU project is not over by any means. And that's perhaps the other thing I should say, that the EU project is not over, it's going to continue growing, they're going to continue taking in borders and other countries if they can into the collective fold. So
and centralising power.
Absolutely, that's the whole point of that. So, and she's flagging that up on the expansion of the EU into North Africa and various other places where really they shouldn't be going, if it's the European Union, that is. So, well worth a look. Check these people out and you'll see that they are talking sense, if you're not sure, that is. Okay.
Thank you, Tony Newton. Thank you so much for sharing. God bless.
Cheers. Thank you.